Welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. That cut opening tonight's show was Metta Prayer by Celia. And happy Women's History Month. We still have a few weeks left to celebrate the women in our lives making a difference. You know, don't put it off and miss the opportunity. Find a woman or women you admire and tell them or her how her efforts affect you and the people around her. You know, we all need that support. We need people to help put gas in our tank. And in honor of Women's History Month, I'm going to get to some of those articles tonight I had not had time for on the last few shows. I'll have those in my What's the Buzz segment after tonight's guests. And speaking of women in our lives, I'd like to pay a short tribute to my mother, Evelyn Montague Gerdes, who passed away this past weekend. Like so many mother-daughter relationships, ours was a complicated one. We were not as close as we might have been. My moving to California for the last 30 years increased the distance, not just by the miles, but strained our bonds as well. You see, my mom was afraid to venture outside her bubble. And for the last 20 years, I've been trying to find compassion and forgiveness for all my disappointment, even though I knew she was doing the best she could, until I had an epiphany. I finally came to this, and I share it with you because the people I've told this to were also helped by it. I came to realize that the distance or detachment was really a gift. Had she been a mother who had strong ideas about what she wanted me to be or wanted my life to look like, I would not have had the freedom to be my authentic self. She tried to be supportive in her own way, even though that meant not really understanding what I write about, never hearing my radio show, or seeing me perform a wedding or give a talk. Yet that space between us allowed me to become who I was meant to be without questioning or argument or pressure. And for that, I thank her. I can say there are two things she did impress upon me, though, that helped shape me. One was to fight for the underdog, because I think she probably felt like one. So she taught me empathy for those needing support. I can hear her now saying, "Karen, don't judge someone till you've walked in their shoes." And the second thing, she said, "Never wait for anything to come knocking at your door. Go out and get it." Something I suspect she wished she could have mustered herself. So thank you, Mom. I'm happy for the woman I've grown up to be. Thank you for being proud of me. Thank you for the important values you taught me. And next time I give a Sunday service, I'm going to wear my leopard print dress in your honor. And when you get up there and you see Jesus, or maybe you're there already, I hope you glimpsed Goddess right there beside him. Well, if you'd like to call in, the number is 718-766-4662. The chat room is also open. And if you're interested in seeing a picture of me when I was about 5 with my mom, check out my Facebook page. You might have to scroll down a little bit to get past the radio show announcements. Also posted there is a talk I gave about life with Mom at Word Salad. It's really pretty funny. And if you listen, you'll catch what I meant by that leopard print dress remark I just made. So that all said, let's turn our attention to tonight's show. Kathy Pagano is with us to tell us the cosmic story, what energies of the new and full moons in the coming weeks will mean for us, Then Heather Mendel, author of the Syzygy, Oracle, Transformational Tarot, and the Tree of Life, Ego, Essence, and the Evolution of Consciousness, is with us to chat about how the Tarot, Kabbalah, and Sacred Feminine are all similar, what coincidence really is, how solar and lunar energies affect us, use of essential oils, and the steps on a hero or heroine's journey. But don't forget, later tonight after my guest, please stay tuned in for my What's the Buzz segment, talking about the bees buzzing around in my bonnet related to the sacred feminine ideals being supported or thwarted in the world today. So, Kathy, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Taryn. And that was a lovely, heartfelt tribute to your mom. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
That was really nice to hear.
Thank you so much.
Yes, so, go ahead.
Well, I was about to say, you know, the people on Facebook have been so incredibly wonderful. There's just been an outpouring of love and support, and I really want to thank everyone. If you're a radio show listener and also my Facebook friend, I really do appreciate it. I was amazed, quite frankly, all the comments that are there. So, you know, thank everyone.
Well, in a way, it seems as if we might, sometimes we lose our moms, but we've gained sisters. And that's the beautiful thing about us right now, I think.
Yep. I think
moms,
that's a really
who don't
good
understand
point.
Us, but good sisters who do.
That's true. You know, my mother, I think, was really afraid for me with all this goddess stuff because she really didn't understand it. And, you know, I think she really believes I'm going to burn in hell. So, you know, what can I say? You know, we were just on different planets. But anyway, you have the, speaking of planets, you have the cosmic story for us tonight with the, you know, the new, well, as a matter of fact, she passed away on a full moon. I thought that was rather interesting. I don't know if it means anything, but and it was just an observation.
A lot of people do, you know, full moons are about awareness and a completion. So it's a beautiful time to finish up a life, especially in the Virgo full moon. Pisces is the end of the astrological year, and it represents the collective unconscious, if you will, going back to the source. And so I hope all your listeners, I hope all of us could do this, but Pisces is a good time to just sort of imagine that you're laying in the ocean, dissolving back to your essential parts. Because what happens is out of that primal ocean comes love. That's what when heaven and earth were separated in the old Greek myth, the being that arose from that travesty, if you will, or necessity, was Aphrodite. And she's the connector. She's the one who connects heaven and earth. And, of course, that's what love does, doesn't it?
True.
We want to get back to, you know, at the end of the astrological year, it's a good time to let go of everything that has accumulated in the last year. And then with the full moon in Virgo, when your mom died, Virgo is the sign of the Virgin. It's the sign of where we ask ourselves, how do I belong to myself? How do I integrate all the different parts of myself? Virgos get a bad rap in patriarchy, but because of the way patriarchy is, I think that's what it is more than anything. But we think we have to be perfect, but it's really about wholeness. And I always tell my Virgo clients, stop trying to be in control and stop trying to be perfect. It's about your lights and darks and your, you know, it's like the difference between a white, you know, a stark white house with square rooms and maybe a Victorian mansion with some cobwebs and some eaten staircases and definitely a little place to sit by the window or window seat on a rainy day where you can cuddle up with a book. So, you know, Virgo has that opportunity to integrate yourself. So with the full moon during Pisces, which is always, you know, the full moon's always in the opposite sign from where the sun is. And so the full moon in Pisces, in Virgo comes during the sun's day in Pisces. And so the Virgo moon says, okay, it's harvest time. What have you harvested this year? What has your soul harvested this year? And who are you? And especially now with this very intense year that we're going through, it's so important for us to get a really good handle on who we are. And so hopefully all of you, this is our last day in Pisces. So I'm hoping everyone who's listening has gone through that dissolving energy, if you will, and sort of coming back together of, okay, this is my essential self. Because tomorrow is spring equinox. Happy spring. Karen?
Yeah, we've had beautiful weather here the last few days. It's really been incredibly gorgeous.
Yes. And all my friends back east are still dealing with snow piled up above their heads. But
wow.
Spring is here. Just for those of you who don't know it, and this is one of the troubles people have sometimes with astrology, because of the wobble of the earth, if you looked at the constellations coming up over the horizon on the morning of the spring equinox, it would be Pisces, because we're in the age of Pisces. We're ending the age of Pisces. But in Western astrology, we say, well, the first day of spring is when the sun comes up over the equator. And so tomorrow the sun, which has been down in the south, is going to finally rise up above the equator, and we'll have that day of balance between light and dark, which is beautiful. And so one of the things, the other thing that's going on, well, we'll talk about that in a minute. So here we are, in Aries. Aries is primal fire. It's like you jump out of the ocean and you go, what do I love? You know, what do I want to be interested in this year? Who am I this year? And there's a lot of energy centered around that question, because all of us know how our earth is in crisis. Our society is literally falling apart. And that's what the cosmic story or the heavens are trying to tell us. It's time to let go of the old so the new can be born. So we're in this very, the dawning of, I wouldn't quite say the age of Aquarius, but we're at the beginning time. The full fulfillment of this won't come for maybe 40 more years or even longer, but we certainly have a lot of work to do, don't we, when we look at the news and see what our environment is, you know, what's happening with the earth and what's happening with our societies and what's happening with the laws and what's happening with the food. So,
I wonder if people in the 60s, you know, during the upheaval, you know, the revolution of love and Vietnam War, I mean, that seemed like a time of big upheaval. You know, I wonder if people who, you know, and if you're in, you know, if you're listening to the show and, you know, you were an adult then and you remember, I wonder if that time felt as chaotic as it does right now, or if it's, if it's really so much more tumultuous everywhere across the globe. You know, I'm thinking maybe the latter, you know, that it's really more tumultuous and crumbling now. But,
yes.
You know.
Back in the 60s, these two planets that are, you know, speaking of this change, they were in a new moon relationship. It was like, yippee, this is kind of fun. Let's try it. But now it's a much more, we're at a crossroads, and it's as if a plant is putting down roots and leaves and growing, and we have to establish a new society. It's a new world. And so that's why the crisis, I think, seems more now than it did back then. I remember my parents telling us, oh, you kids, but we never should have sent you to college. Look what you're doing. You're all crazy. Is this why we raised you?
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I remember parents complaining about rock music, you know, like that was the worst thing in the world.
Right. Yeah, definitely. But, you see, they're very much, they were the Pluto and Cancer generation. They wanted to make good, you know, they wanted to secure their family and their home. Cancer, the, you know, home and family and country. And then we were the Pluto and Leo generation, and we went, and there's a wonderful book by P.J. O'Rourke, I'm sure a lot of you know about him, a humorist, definitely, but he called a book called The Baby Boom, and he described the Pluto and Leo generation perfectly, but without knowing the astrology, I don't think. And it was all about imagination, about we were the first children to really give play to our imagination, which is very Leo-like. It's a playful sign. And Pluto, is, when it goes through its sign, says, we have to change this. And I think that's why my generation, half of us grew up and half of us didn't, because it's the sign of the divine child. So a lot of people didn't bother to grow up. But anyway, I think it's much more crisis-oriented now, because a square, a 90-degree angle between these two planets, always speaks more of a crisis of action, whereas back in the 60s it was much more about, oh, something new is being born and I want to be part of it. I don't know what it is, but let's do it.
Yeah, you didn't have the crisis feel to it.
Right. And, you know, and we've known since the 70s that we need to take better care of our Earth and that women need freedom. And now we're coming up against the forces of the old, which always, patriarchy has this very, you know, bad problem. It doesn't want to die. Mm. And it's afraid of death. And in all the old myths of the gods, especially the Greek gods, they were constantly eating their children because they didn't want to let go.
Didn't want their children secede them.
Right. And we really, our children need to have us support them because they're the ones who are going to have to live with this poor, you know, poisoned earth that we've left them. So that's the sad part. But anyway, so this is what's happening right now. The that energy from the 60s, it's Uranus, freedom and awareness and waking up. You know, Uranus is brilliant. It's about rebellion and freedom, and Pluto about evolution, but through death and rebirth, like the ancient god Pluto and Persephone, the spring maiden who's coming back tomorrow, Demeter and Persephone. That goddess duo was really about the fact that we live in a cycle of death, of birth, death, and rebirth, of regeneration, the soil and the crops get regenerated, and that's what patriarchy doesn't believe in. But anyway, so here we are at this part of the cycle, and Pluto, as I mentioned last time, is breaking down the structures in our government and financial institutions, just our social system, that really are dead. And I guess when they talk about the zombie apocalypse, I have no idea what that means, but it always hits me that it's we got a bunch of dead walking dead running the government and the world.
It's time to go shoot them in the head. Metaphorically speaking, I'm just saying what I... I realized as those words left my mouth that I needed to clarify, you know, that's how they kill the zombies on The Walking Dead.
That's right. Well, you know, it's such a fear of death that you can't let go. And it is a fear of death, whether it's because the Catholic Church scares the hell out of everybody thinking we're all going to go to hell or at least burn in purgatory or what, but it's patriarchy. The worst thing about patriarchy is the refusal of death as a transformation into a new life, you know, a rebirth into another life. And so we have that. And then, you know, challenging that is the planet Uranus, the wake-up call in Aries, saying, okay, who are you? Who do you want to be? Because Aries is very much about our self-identity. And so we have to re-identify ourselves right now in terms of this breakdown of the culture. And the thing that's fascinating and intense about this next month is that there's two other planets being added to that. So instead of just two planets at a 90-degree angle, there are four planets forming a cross. So four 90-degree angles, two 180-degree, you know, angles, two oppositions, two squares. And in cardinal signs, which is the signs that change the season, Aries is the spring equinox, Cancer is the summer solstice, Libra is the fall equinox, and Capricorn is the winter solstice, they change the season. So we have this cross that needs to be pushed and changed, and the change will come. And so we have the energies of Jupiter and Cancer, which Jupiter likes to expand things and add spirit. And in Cancer, it's about mothering and nurturing. and family. And so one of the ways we could talk about it is, who is our family? Who's our family? Is it our family of birth? Is it our family of friends? Or is it the human family? And that might be where we have to put our attention. And then the fourth element is Mars in Libra, which is going retrograde. And if you listened to the last time I was on, it's been an interesting beginning of the year because all the personal planets are going backwards at a different point. From winter solstice to the end of January, Venus went backwards. And when planets look like they go backwards, it's that I have to reconsider this. Let me see what I really want. Let me see what I really feel about this. So we had Venus retrograde, and when that went direct, Mercury went retrograde, which we all know about. That was in February. And when Mercury went direct, Mars went retrograde. And so it's almost as if all of these planets are saying, you know, we really have to rethink about how we live. Is it sustainable? Is it appropriate anymore? And Mars is in Libra, and with all the war and breast thumping that's going on with some of these war hawks, especially in America and in Russia, you wonder and you think, wow, is Mars is in Libra. It's supposed to be about diplomacy. It's supposed to be about what is our desires, and are we being selfish, or do we take other people into consideration when we think about what we desire? Because Mars is very much about our desires and self-preservation. You know, it's all about me. And so here it is going backwards in the sign of relationship, and it's saying, maybe I need to rethink this whole thing about, is it all about me? And hopefully, you know, we're not going to go to war, and we're going to let people resolve their own issues, hopefully. And that's going to be another part of this grand cross. And so I think it's, you know, there's a lot coming up for everybody, and the best thing you can all do is center yourself. And what you need to do perhaps is, I was thinking and talking with other astrologers, because this is all happening the weekend of right around the 15th of April to the 23rd, right around Passover and Easter and Tax Day, and there's going to be a lunar eclipse on the 15th.
My book launch party. My book launch party.
That's right. That's right. So all of this is happening then. But the interesting thing is it's happening on America's 4th of July chart sun. So when a planetary configuration affects the chart of a nation, it affects the nation. And so, you know, we were talking about, well, is it going to be some big thing that's going to explode, like the military takeover of America, or you know, the food being poisoned totally, or the government giving Monsanto the right to, you know, control all our food, or the Supreme Court, you know, giving corporations even more power, or the banks failing. You know, there's so many different things that can come up, and then I realized in a meditation, well, you know, we can't do anything about that. That's already powers in play. But what we can do is we can take it in ourselves, and we can be the best that we can be. And we can go out and relate to people with honor and dignity. We can, and respect and courtesy. We can own our own archetypal identity, teacher, healer, storyteller, you know, goddess, priestess, any of those things. We can include everyone in our family and give people who need to be nurtured that. So there's many, and we can let go of the rules in ourselves. It's, you know, we really need to get rid of the patriarchal rules that shape our personality as well. So there's so many ways we can go out and radiate out a new story just by being who we are. And I think that's the only thing we really can do. You might end up doing it by writing an article in the newspaper about something, or going to a town council meeting and being truthful about a situation, or you just might talk to your neighbors in a different way and let them see who you really are and what you really believe. But it's going to be a very intense few weeks, I would say a very intense month. So one of the things I did was I wrote down some of the intense days, and if people want to write them down, they can. On April Fool's Day, there's going to be a crisis in terms of, feeling, do we have enough? Do I have enough? Or maybe do all of us have enough? On the 2nd, there's going to be the sun is going to come up to Uranus, which is already in Aries, and so watch out for surprises. Then on the 3rd, it's going to connect with Pluto, and you're going to say, oh, my God, what's falling apart? And then on the 8th, it's going to be opposite Mars, and you're going to see in the world how you treat people and how other people treat you. And then on the 15th, there's a lunar eclipse, and that's always an ending of something. And it's in Aries and Libra because we've shifted now from Taurus and Scorpio eclipses, which are all about resources, now to Aries and Libra, which is all about relationships. So, it's hard to, in a quick way, to describe this, but if people want more information, they can read my newsletters at on my website, that which will be going up. The ones on Pisces are already up, but the newer ones on the new moon in Aries and what's going on, there'll be articles up there. But all I can say is ground and center and hold on to your hat and see what these next months bring you. Read the signs. See how people are relating to you. See how you're relating to other people. That's going to be the most important thing, I think.
Okay. And Kathy, if you want to mention how to reach your newsletter or website again.
Okay. It's www.wisdom-of-astrology.com. If you forget to put the dashes in between Wisdom of Astrology, you'll get Alan Leo's, you'll get another astrologer's site, and he's very good too, but if you want mine, it's wisdom-of-astrology.com. And read up on some of the old newsletters so you understand what we're coming into. But it's an intense time. It's a time for the gods to come back, definitely, right now. We need women who are wise. When I talk to people, they don't seem to realize, and this hit me the other day, when patriarchy cut women off, killed us during the burning times and made women afraid to teach their daughters the ancient mysteries, we got cut off from the earth. Women are the ones who are connected to the earth. We're the mouthpieces of Mother Earth. And we totally lost touch with her because we have not been allowed to exercise our gifts. I think we all need to start exercising that gift, don't you, Karen?
Oh, I think so, too. I was listening to some women talk today on the news who were saying women really don't need equal pay and, we don't really need to be worried about all of these social issues, i.e., access to contraception, abortion, that kind of thing. These were right-wing women. And I was,
right.
As you were talking about that, I was thinking, we have different extremes of cut off, And I was just thinking, how would I describe it? It's almost as if, patriarchy has indoctrinated or brainwashed these women to the point where, they are complicit in their own oppression and they don't even
That's
realize
right.
that they are shackling themselves, And,
right.
and
they're father's daughters. They're patriarch daughters of the patriarchy who unfortunately, like Athena and Orestes, says, I am for the masculine in all things.
Yes. Yes, and instead of being, being unto themselves, being connected to the earth, being connected to their feminine, some of us have a long way yet to go.
Right, and unfortunately, we've given over, I think my generation from the 60s, a lot of the people who were spiritual, we went and studied spirituality and alternative healing and all wonder and goddesses and all wonderful things. But we let the more unconscious right-wing people take over the government. And so there's women in government, but they're father's daughters so often. and they don't stand up for the things of the earth and of the feminine. And that's why someone like Marianne Williamson, God bless her, you know, running for Congress. If more women like that, or Maya Angelou or Oprah or people, I don't know, women who just us, you and me, if we actually, you know, as we got older and recognized that our job now is to help everyone as we get older, the grandmothers, and speaking of which, I'll mention something before I go, that we need to get it involved in our culture, especially on a community level, but, you know, who knows, on whatever level, because it is our culture. We can say, I don't like politics, and we don't have to do that, politics, but we need to engage in our world and bring some wisdom there.
Yeah, we have to do more than just chat on Facebook.
and talk to each other. We're preaching to the choir all the time.
Right.
That's why I thought, you know, I love to be home. I'm a 12th house hermit in astrology. I love to write and be back in my own house and just see my friends and go to my rituals and do my group thing. But I'm going to make myself go out and just meet people during the next 2 or 3 weeks and radiate out who I am, whether they like me or not. I'm not going to try to save them, but I'm going to be me. And just by that, it helps. And
there you go.
We need to be involved, you know. Speaking of which, before I go, you might know about this already, but tomorrow is the equinox. Saturday is World Water Day, I think, and the 13 indigenous grandmothers want us all to do water blessing on that day. And basically they want us to either go to a body of water or take a bowl of water and pray over it, first apologizing for how we have not taken care of it, and then sending blessings to it and having those blessings go to all the waters of the world, and then participating in that and honoring the waters. And I think that's a beautiful, beautiful thing to do. So
absolutely.
People, if you... You know,
What's the date this Saturday?
This Saturday, March 22nd. But you know what? The goddess is timeless and eternal. And so even if you listen to this and it's next week, you can do it then too.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Right?
That's a very important point. Because, you know, if you know that Emoto guy, I forget his name, you know, he shows us how praying over water actually changes the molecular structure of it. So it doesn't matter what day you do it, just do it.
That's right.
Well, Kathy, thank you so much. I know you have a class waiting for you, so we will let you go. But thank you for being with us again, and we will see you in another few weeks.
Okay, take care, and happy spring, everyone.
Okay, same to you. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Well, listeners, I see my next guest is on the switchboard, and I'm going to ask her to just indulge me for another minute or two here, because I got a little bit of show business to take care of before we start our interview. I have a word from Joe Carson in Dancing with Gaia. Joe helps me pay to keep Voices of the Sacred Feminine on the air with her commercials. That said, if you like what you're hearing and you want to ensure the show keeps on the airwaves here at Blog Talk, it's not free. I have to pay out of my pocket to have these wonderful guests for you every week, you know, week in and week out, month in and month out, year in and year out, because we've been on the air like almost 10 years now, if you can believe it. So please, if you want to help, go to my website at KarenTate.com. Once there, go to my Goddess store page, scroll down to the PayPal buttons at the bottom, make a donation of any amount. You know, don't feel funny sending $5, because if five people send $5, that's $25. You know what I mean? It all adds up. And thank you. Thank you for you folks who have sent donations. Thank you for your kind emails that let me know what I'm doing is making a difference. Thank you for your show ideas and articles and all of that good stuff. So here we go. Joe Carson, Dancing with Gaia.
Most people's psychic experiences are dreaming. And it's thought that it's the pineal gland making this chemical that does it. Now, this was the core finding that the pineal gland makes a hallucinogen. We all hallucinate. We all go into a state of consciousness that for me is the collective unconscious. This psychic state is the collective unconscious, which is that consciousness of the planet, what's called the cosmic mind, the mind of the earth. Because all peoples, all races, all tribes from the past and right around the world have myths and legends which use symbols and archetypes which are identical. Identical. Every human being experiences this state of consciousness, which is the dream mind. That symbolic, archetypal, exemplified by fairy tales, or the creation myths and legends of all the different peoples. The symbols of them are the same, and to me that is the consciousness of the earth speaking to us.
Well, that was Serena Roney Dougal, PhD, speaking in Joe Carson's film, Dancing with Gaia. Dancing with Gaia explores the connection between earth energy, sacred sexuality, and the goddess as Gaia. It features different visionaries, 15 altogether, like Serena, who give tools to feel the life of the planet within ourselves. The DVD comes with a 45-page mini book and costs just $20. You can get your own copy at dancingwithgaia.com. And I have seen it, listeners. It is well worth the money. I think it's really important to have it in your library. So think about it for yourself or for a friend. And if you've been tuning in the last couple months, you know I've been sharing news about my new book, Goddess Calling. I was really amazed to see the book doing well on Amazon. So please, if you haven't checked it out yet, please don't hesitate. Amazon still has a great deal on Goddess Calling. It costs $12 and change. If I can sell a few hundred more there or elsewhere, the publisher will be ecstatic and it will mean good things for me in the book beyond the monetary, because really we make hardly anything on these books. But please pick up a copy, and if you'd prefer not to give your business to Amazon, I can understand that. Multinational companies are always squeezing out the little guys. Please go to your local bookseller. They can get it too. And if you're in the United States, you can also get a copy from me if you prefer. Just go to my website, KarenTate.com, go to the Goddess Store page, and I'll even sign it for you. And once you're there at my website, don't miss the free stuff. There's downloadable meditations, great links to good information, lots of interviews where I've been interviewed myself, talking to other show hosts about the importance of the sacred feminine, to reshape our future, and of course, links to my books, appearances, wonderful reviews I'm getting from mentors and peers. So we are crossing the threshold. You know what that sound means. And we are about to chat with Heather Mandel, and I hope you'll stay tuned for my What's the Buzz segment. Tonight I'm discussing a few different things, commentary on our beloved, on one of our past shows, Beyond 50 Shades of Grey. Very interesting if you listen to that show. I have an article on Is Religion the Biggest Problem Facing Feminism, written by Christine Schenck and sent in by Jeanette. Then there's A Day in the Life of Joe Republican, sent in by Jane. Then sent in from Days for Girls website by Pat. I'm going to tell you a wonderful story about the sanitary pad revolution in India that was posted by Vibiki Vimina from the BBC World Service. And if there's time, Ms. Magazine had an article about Indian women reclaiming the buses for International Women's Day. But it's time to chat with Heather. Let me tell you about her. She's South African-born, a mystic, an author, an artist, teacher. Heather Mandel's newest work, she's going to have to help me pronounce this. This is, Heather, is it the Syzygy?
Syzygy, yes.
Thank you. The Syzygy Oracle, Transformational Tarot and the Tree of Life, Ego Essence and the Evolution of Consciousness, which brings together her passionate interests in art, calligraphy, myth, and mysticism. Her early books are Dancing in the Footsteps of Eve, which offers the foundational feminine archetype as a hero rather than a villain, and Towards Freedom, a feminist Haggadah for Men and Women. Her website is her name, Heather Mendel, HeatherMendel.com, and she also has sacredfemininekabbalah.com. So indulge me a second here, Heather. What is a Haggadah?
A Haggadah is the story of the Exodus that we're about to read at Passover time. It's a story that's normally told in the male voice by fathers to their sons. And in the last probably 25 to 30 years, people have reinterpreted the Haggadah. I've done mine towards freedom, using not only the feminine voice of mothers to their daughters, but also using an introduction to Kabbalah, making it something that appeals hopefully to the feminists in men and women as an ongoing story of liberating ourselves from sexism of the past.
Well, you know, isn't that what it's all about? You know, the sacred feminine liberates us, and the divine masculine, at least the way it's been practiced under patriarchy, it oppresses it, it exploits us, it dominates us, and some of us don't even get that. There's a lot of awakening that has to happen on our planet, don't you think?
Absolutely. I was listening to your earlier segment, fascinating, and when I was hearing you talk about these right-wing women, I can think of Gloria Steinem's comment about these were female imposters, and they don't actually know it. But hopefully there are more of us who are waking up and who are playing a part in trying to bring sacred feminine energy into the world and awakening it in one another and strengthening each other and giving each other support as we go to recreate our world.
Well, you said it, sister. And, you know, we have so many great men who get it too, you know, and they're our allies in this.
Yes.
You know, and I hear from a lot of them, actually. Some of them have even been on my show. And I think that's one of the misconceptions out there. You know, every time I go around and talk about this, people always think, if they're new to this, that it's about women wanting to take over the world. They don't understand that men are in this with us.
Absolutely. That's why when I wrote my Haggadah, I put that it was a feminist Haggadah for men and women, because I think that as we work around in a circle and we equalize and strengthen each other, that's where the balance is going to come in, not one hierarchy taking over from another.
Okay. So, all right. Well, Heather, let's chat about your book, Tarot, The Tree of Life.
Yes.
You know, I did take, some Kabbalah classes, so I know a little bit about the Kabbalah. I actually took some of the classes because I was so thrilled that they honored the sacred feminine, that, you know, they even said things like they thought women were more spiritual, that if men hoped to achieve happiness and wholeness, they had to embrace the feminine within themselves. You know, we know the Shekinah. So how is Tarot, the Kabbalah, you know, and the sacred feminine, I think some of us know that they're connected, but, you know, maybe you want to explain maybe how specifically they're all connected.
Sure. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on, Karen, and for giving me this opportunity to talk. I think probably we all see the world as we are rather than as it is. And for somebody who's really learned to appreciate the mystical aspect of Judaism and see how it applies and enriches my own life, that vision, I think, accompanies me wherever I go. And so that when I looked at Tarot as an adult rather than a teenager, which I had done in the 60s, and realized that Tarot was actually or portrayed to be a fortune-telling device, I was a little bit skeptical of it in terms of the fact that the imagery that I saw therein was not very welcoming to me as a Jew, because there was a lot of the iconography and language, like the devil and the hierophant, that had no real meaning for me. But as a maturing woman, a feminist and a mystic, when I went back to the tarot a couple of years ago, the first thing that struck me as I looked at it, that there were 22 cards in the major arcana. 22 struck me as an interesting number, because the way we number things in the West, if it had been 20 cards or 25,
that's more in keeping with the way we number in tens and twenties and so on. But 22 is an unusual number, and for me, being a mystic and being Jewish, the immediate association came up. That's very interesting because there are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, and as a mystic, even more interesting, 22 pathways on the Tree of Life, which I'm not sure how many people are familiar with, but it's a diagram used by the Kabbalists to really explain the interrelationship and balance between everything that is. It can be applied to anything. And so this number 22 was really the catch or the coincidental noticing that got me curious to see if I could find any connection between tarot as one ancient wisdom tradition and Jewish mysticism as another, all being linked by this number 22. And it took me into a very exciting adventure in my own life. Whether it's meaningful to every Kabbalist out there, I have no idea. Whether it's meaningful to every woman out there who, like me, is in search of the sacred feminine, I have no idea. But at least if it gives somebody an opportunity to think a little differently, to experience things a little differently, then I feel we've accomplished something wonderful.
Well, you know, I think it's so important that we all take responsibility for our own education. And whenever we can kind of expand our horizons or raise our awareness or, you know, kind of metaphorically put another book on the shelf of our mind, right. You know, it just sort of all adds to, you know, that vast wealth of knowledge we have. You know, I don't think we could, you know, we should ever stop learning and making all these connections of, you know, that shows more and more how we're, you know, how things are really interconnected.
Absolutely. And I think that when we take these various diverse traditions and respect those of others and try and reinterpret them in terms of ourselves and see where we can bring old traditions to life and take what is valuable out of them, bringing them into a new perspective, I think we enhance not only our own spiritual growth, but hopefully those of others as we connect with them. And so this approach of looking at tarot and looking at Kabbalah, which I was really interested, Karen, when you said, you know, you could see the appreciation of the sacred feminine within it. I've always seen Kabbalah that way. But in my early days, when I first started writing Dancing in the Footsteps of Eve, and I was trying to present this in L.A., actually at some sort of colloquium at USC, and talking about Kabbalah as an opportunity to meet the sacred feminine, I was looked at as if I was completely crazy and was told by some of the women there, don't you know that this is a male, you know, male teaching and a male wisdom?
Yeah.
I said, well, you know, I think it's what you bring to it, what you see. But for me, Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, is really talking about the balance in everything between masculine and feminine, between the hidden and the revealed, between all the paradoxes that we see in our lives. This Tree of Life explains it so beautifully and lends itself to a perfect analogy for seeing the sacred feminine in the tarot cards as the hero's journey that all we women undertake as we empower ourselves to become all that we can be.
I want to go back to that. Let's make sure we get back to that heroine's journey. But I want to digress just a little bit because you offer me a rare opportunity to ask a question that I might actually be able to get an answer to. I think you may know. Going back to my days at the Kabbalah Center here in Los Angeles, I went to the one that the Bergs, Karen Berg and her late husband, founded and ran. I found it, the thing that did annoy me, I have to admit, was that every time there was a holy day, we were always revering some old male rabbi. But the interesting part about it, Heather, was the stuff that they said that the rabbis were, you know, suggesting we do in our lives, you know, the values, the ideals, they always smacked of sacred feminine ideals. And I couldn't help but think, had these old rabbis really been taught from some matriarchal culture, and maybe they just didn't get credit for it. I couldn't let that idea go. And I wonder if that, you know, if there's Am I crazy? Or I mean, is there any...
No, I don't think you're crazy at all. I think that you're picking up... I believe when you come to any wisdom tradition and looking at Kabbalah particularly, which you know is traditionally you couldn't study unless you were 40 years old, a male, and well-versed in Torah. That's how it was sort of kept in a clique and not available to women to be taught. However, I think that when you go to the tradition yourself, you go to this ancient wellspring of incredible wisdom that is very, very ancient. There are two ways, I think, of accessing its wisdom. One of it is going by the letter of the law, which I think would very much bring us all, women who are interested in this, against these three prescriptions about who can study. Or we can go to the spirit of the law. And I think that within the spirit of the law and what is actually the message that is waiting to be revealed in Kabbalah is this honoring of the sacred feminine and this intuitive understanding, this revelation, really, that is what we pick up from the written words and the images it creates for ourselves and the incredible knowledge base that is there that is crying for our approaching it as women in search of the sacred feminine. It's all there because it's a system of balance. So whether one wants to go to a lot of the male rabbis who have taught this according to real left-brain linear thinking, or go to women who are approaching it through an intuitive grasp of what is actually hidden within the words. You know, we're told there are two Torahs. One is written in the black letters on white paper or white parchment. The other written in white letters of fire, if you like, in the spaces in the dark. And I love that because it really talks to me about bringing our intuitive wisdom to mine for all the things that exist within the mystery of the unknown. And the Kabbalah is about bringing those known and unknown, revealed and unrevealed, to consciousness and bringing that in as part of what our job is here on earth as we are trying to repair our world, tikkun olam, as we're trying to bring together everything that we can and create a new way of being. And I think people like yourself, Karen, and the show that you're running and the work that you're doing is playing such an important role in that. I posted this on Facebook several times, just inviting people to see what exactly you're doing to make this world a better place because you're in it. And that's really what Judaism's asking all of us to do.
And you know, and actually, when we were at the Kabbalah Center, it was interesting that it felt like they didn't often know that they were being patriarchal. They just thought everybody had their own roles to play. And you know, I wasn't sure if they were unconscious or you know, anyway. But the point, I guess, where I'm trying to go with this, there are a lot of women now who I think are reclaiming Kabbalah. You know, and the sacred feminine. They are sort of throwing off the patriarchal shackles and reclaiming it for themselves. Yes. And I think that's so important. You know, as women, we really do have to reclaim and rethink and just reawaken everything. And you know, this is just another part of that. And
exactly.
Well, you know, you were mentioning coincidence before, one of the things I was really curious to hear you talk about was how you believe coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous. And when you say God, I'm sure you mean God, goddess. You're not just referring
it
to a patriarchal God.
No, exactly. I really talk about, in my own prayer language, I just talk about divinity, that we can then fix however we want that image to be, you know, a presence that's way beyond gender. But I do believe that coincidence makes us aware that there is a force beyond ourselves that is connecting or helping us to connect the dots. The same way as this number 22 was a coincidental noticing of something unusual that drew me along the path, even my unpronounceable name of my deck came to me as, I think, a coincidental, I don't know what you call it, a hunch because I knew the work that I was doing. I knew that what it was trying to bring together was two ancient traditions, balancing of the male and the female, the physical and the spiritual, in the words of our mutual friend Barbara Marks Hubbard, a bringing together of the ego and the essence of who we all are. And I was trying to think my way through or feel my name, my way through to a title. And one morning in an early meditation when I happened to be at my most perceptive, the word syzygy, which I couldn't pronounce either, Karen, so don't feel bad about it, but this word appeared to me, and I'm thinking, syzygy? I could see the letters because I'd used this as a calligrapher. I used to do some certificates for best restaurants in North America, and one of the restaurants was a restaurant in Aspen called Syzygy, and that word appealed to me as a calligrapher. It had such flow and such beauty, and so in this morning meditation, when I get this word syzygy, I didn't know how to pronounce it. I didn't know what it actually meant other than a beautiful calligraphic image. So I went to the dictionary to look it up, and, you know, when these coincidences come the way they do, you've got to laugh, because I believe God has a humor, Goddess has a humor, and wants a sense of humor, and wants us to be able to laugh at these things that are just so wonderful. I found in the dictionary that syzygy has two meanings. It's used by astronomers, and I mean astronomers, not astrologers, to talk about the connection of the earth, the moon and the sun at various parts in the cosmic cycle of dance, if you like. Jung used the term as the balancing of the opposites. And I just laughed out loud because really and truly the way I've put the syzygy oracle together, it's talking about a balancing of the opposite, and it's talking about our relationship to both the sun, which is the lighting of the ways, if you like, in our development, and the moon, which really we as women relate to so strongly, and which gives ability to our inner selves, the hidden, mysterious aspects, the intuitive, imaginative aspects of ourselves, to come to the fore so that we can again balance the sun and the moon in our own lives, the solar and the lunar energy, as we take this heroic journey forward that the 22 cards of the Major Arcana, 22 pathways of the Tree of Life, the 22 stages of the Hebrew letters, all enlighten for us as we each take this journey of beginnings, of initiations, and of coming back with something different to begin a new journey all over again.
Because that is what either the hero or the heroine's journey is, isn't it?
Exactly. And, you know, I think that people think of, you know, the life journey, its birth. We go through a number of experiences and move towards death. I think that journey, we begin so many times in so many different circumstances of our lives. We begin it every time we have a new passion in our lives, when we begin a new job, a vocation, an avocation, a relationship. We are called into something new and a new part of the cycle begins. We go in with naivete and innocence and trust that it's all going to work out well. We then discover, you've written books, Karen, you know, if you knew what writing a book was going to be all about, would you have undertaken it?
I've said, you know, that so many times. Were you listening?
I must have been, but I've thought it too. We go in, we've got this great feeling of something we've got to do. It may be a relationship, it may be a passion, whatever it is. We start off like the first card in the tarot deck with innocence and naivete, believing this is all good. We go through various stages. We're given gifts by our mentors to take us on this incredible journey. We come to a stage where threshold guardians are there to allow us the opportunity to see how we use the gifts that we were given until we bring this full cycle and we actually enjoy the fruits of our success. We see the book in our hand. We've set a beautiful table for dinner. We've created a beautiful garden. We've raised a child that we're proud to offer out into the world. We've done something that we need to celebrate before the cycle begins again. And the next part of the heroic journey begins as our attention is drawn to something else. So we've got these mini journeys going on within the greater cycle of our lives, the tarot is a wonderful way to tune into this. I've used it as an introduction not only to the Hebrew alphabet, but to the Kabbalah, but also to women, because I think that when you look at the traditional tarot deck, it's a very patriarchal set of images. And when I looked at it as a feminist in search of the sacred feminine, I suddenly thought the wisdom of the cards is there. What if I was to take away the illustrations that are so masculine and replace heroic female figures that empower all of us? How would that change the flavor of the deck of the tarot? And so I did do many changes. I put in female characters except for the one card, the sacred masculine. I've kept on the one card, which is normally where the emperor is, because I believe that we all have sacred masculine energy within us, and we need to balance that within ourselves. So that's the only male image in my deck of 22 cards. But the rest, I hope, are elegant female figures that will appeal to all of us and that will empower us to take on the heroic stories of the archetypal females that I have assigned to each of these cards.
I'm wondering, Heather, is it possible to, like, give us an example of, major arcana tarot cards and give its partner in Kabbalah, the one that would sort of, parallels it?
Okay, well, what I've done is I have assigned each of these cards to a pathway rather than to a female character out of Kabbalah. But what I've done is, if we take, for example, the very first card in the traditional tarot is considered to be the fool. It is the beginner, the naivete within us that starts out trusting and moving out into an unknown circumstance. I've used biblical Eve from my last book when I worked on Dancing the Footsteps of Eve. I show that Eve, the way we understood her, is, I think, completely not the way it was ever intended. She is the courageous, intuitive energy within all of us that allows us to move into the unknown and to try something new. So I've assigned her to the first card that I no longer call the fool. I call this card initiating. I changed the names of every one of the 22 cards to a verb instead of a noun, because I believe everything is in process, and I think that the idea of having these cards called by nouns gives a very static feeling. So instead of the fool, it's initiating, and the theme of the card is I trust. And if we take that Eve energy within ourselves and we move forward into the unknown, we are doing exactly what we were intended to do, with courage, with conviction, with humor, with blessing, as we go curiosity into the world as was intended. I've placed that card at the top of the tree as intuition first emerges and meets the great first pair of wisdom and understanding. So it wouldn't really be easy for me to assign Eve to a Kabbalistic figure, but on that pathway where intuition, intention, the very first spark of something different comes into materiality, into the world as we know it, and moves into the great sphere of wisdom and understanding that we have to learn to balance. And so I've taken each one of these cards and placed them in a circular route around the tree of life, from where energy first manifests all the way down through physicality and then back up to the point of origin. Again, coming as a woman, instead of seeing this tree of life as a linear document going from top to bottom, I've used the diagram in a circular fashion, starting from a point of the unknown where we don't know where our own beginnings are, but it goes in a circular motion and returns back to that same unknown from which we emerged. And so I think, again, coming as a feminist, as a woman in search of the sacred feminine, some of these things are really breaks from the old way of doing Kabbalah or doing tarot, but come, I think, with a fresh impulse to just honor all that is worshipful within both these wisdom traditions.
Well, you know, Heather, it sounds brilliant. I love what you did, Eve. And why don't you just say how you renamed the cards? You know, give us what the
yes.
noun was and the new name, the new verb name you've given it.
I would be happy to. On each card, I've given a name and I've given a theme. So, for example, the Fool becomes initiating, and the theme is I trust. The second card was the Magician. I've got it focused, and the title of it is Focusing, and I believe. You know, we talk in computer talk, we say what you see is what you get. I really believe what we believe is what we get.
Oh,
and
me
so
too.
I've used the, good. I've used the Magus there to ask us to look at what we believe and how we use our beliefs to shape our reality, because as I said a little earlier, we don't see the world as it is, we see it as we are, and what we believe is really going to influence the way we see everything. The third card in the traditional tarot is the High Priestess. I've called that card Allowing, and the theme of it is I Await. We are given a mystical sense of what is beyond the magic that the second card brought in. But we have to allow things to ripen and to give them time. Our mystical sense probably grows as we get older, and in order to really understand, we have to allow things to take their natural course. The Empress becomes nurturing. It's all about unconditional love and talking of the sacred feminine. That is part, I think, of what sacred feminine energy really is. The fifth card is the Emperor. I've called that structuring. I think that we all need to have some sort of way that we can organize our intuitive thoughts, or they can run away with us. We need in this physical world to bring ego and essence together. We need to bring intuition together with the physical needs that we have in the world in order to get on. So the fifth card is about structuring. Am I taking up too much time, or would you like to go?
No, you know, let's not go through all of them, but I think this is brilliant. And honestly, I have to tell you, I've never felt drawn to the tarot, but the way
yes.
you're describing it, I really think I have to get a deck.
Well, I hope yours, if it hasn't arrived. I was hoping it would have got there already, but it's on the way. But my feeling is that what I was hoping to do with this, for people who have been stayed away from tarot, I'm hoping that this will give them an opportunity to look beyond what they may have heard. Everybody understands, they see the image of the death card, which is the one card everybody knows, and they know that the media uses this as a sign of bad things to come. When we think about it, death, as the really the meaning of a death card, is not the end to physical life. It could be the natural letting go of a circumstance that has caused us great grief, and in order to move on, we have to be able to release that so we can make way for the new. So the death card doesn't always symbolize that. I think that's one of the reasons that have kept people away from tarot, a fear of this fortune-telling aspect.
Yeah.
What I've done with the cards is really taken them out of that realm, and I've created out of this a daily spiritual practice for men and women, but it's mainly women to whom this appeals. Made this into a spiritual practice that somebody can draw one of these cards for a day, a week, a month, whatever feels right. I recommend looking at the image. I've drawn all of these images on black backgrounds, to which I added color and light. I did that really to honor the mystery in all of our lives. So we start off in the darkness and this image emerges. I ask people using the deck, before you go and read what the card actually says and all the heroes that are attached to it and the Kabbalah and the Hebrew letters, look at what the card says to you. There's sacred geometry in there. There's a powerful female figure. The colors are used in a specific way. Look at the image and see what it says. It reminds me, somebody once said, when we go into an art museum, how many of us just go and look at the artwork? Or how many of us go and read the little blurb alongside of it to see what we're supposed to see when we look at the art? So I'd like people just to look at the cards, see what the card is saying, and then go and do the reading that goes along with it and see how that applies to your life at this particular moment, knowing that for sure the one thing we guaranteed it's going to be changing. For those of us who are going through difficult times, that's really good news. For those of us who are enjoying the fruits of something wonderful, we don't want to know that change is coming. But this card deck and the Kabbalah, they're all talking to us about the changes that are natural, that it's all good. We're moving towards good. Even in the most difficult of times, there's light at the end of the tunnel. Something will come. We're growing. We're becoming more than we were had we not been through our circumstances of loss or difficulty. And that there are more opportunities for celebrating the gifts that we've been given and the gifts that we can make to the world than there are these moments of loss, of dealing with anger, of dealing with frustration, of dealing with fear. That's another one the cards talk about. And there are ways and exercises that one can do. I try to make this book a how-to-do-it kind of a book that we can journal as we go, that we can use these cards to highlight where we are in our own particular journey at this particular time, which will be different to the way we are tomorrow or next week or next year.
Yeah, this sounds like you've really done an awesome job with this. And I want to make sure we get on to the Hebrew letters and sacred geometry and also the sacred oils. So the last question I'm going to ask you about the cards, and forgive me if you said this, I think I missed it, the death card. How did you rename the death card?
The death card I've called releasing and
ideals.
Yes, and you know, if you look at the death card in the traditional deck, it's a pretty fearsome, it's a fearsome illustration of a skeleton in a hood on horseback trampling over bodies beneath its feet. Well, anybody who was going to draw a card that looked like that, I think that kind of, you know, draws you up short. What I've done is looking at the releasing, I think that the image is of a woman who is keening. She's rolled over in grief. She's facing the west, which in Jewish mystical terms, west really talks about endings and blendings. You know, as the day ends and the sun goes down, the mystery becomes more apparent. She's facing the west. What she doesn't see above her is that a new green leaf is growing on the tree above her, and she doesn't see that in the east or behind her, a new day is dawning. In fact, I've done it as a double circle. There are two possibilities, because I believe there's always more than just one way of solving any dilemma. In her grief, she cannot see that the signs of life are all around her, and it's only when she's able to lift up her head that she realizes, you know, life continues. She sees the green leaf, she sees the dawn, and she understands intuitively that as painful as whatever it is that she is letting go of, and I'm really using the death card to talk about the losses that we all face on different levels, but we have to let go in order to make way for the new. Look at society right now, having to let go of all the patriarchal structures that we've got, that we take, as you were talking earlier. Some people don't even realize, excuse me, they're in the grip of all of this. But we have to release all these things that we assumed was the way the world worked in order for something better to actually enter our lives. And it's that willingness to release that is so difficult for us.
Right, right. Well, it's scary. Well, Heather, I just feel the wisdom you have that you put into this deck. I mean, it's just brilliant. So before we run out of time, because we probably got about 15 minutes left at most, talk a little bit about the mystery of the Hebrew letters with sacred geometry.
Yes, two different aspects altogether. Again, when I said to you, when I first looked at tarot, I felt estranged from it because there were so many Christian symbols in it that I didn't feel very welcome. And so when I came to it now as a feminist and as a mystic, I thought, well, what if I try to put in symbols into these cards that are more universal along the ideas of Jung symbols, somebody that talks to all of us irrespective of what our religious or spiritual or no tradition is. And I thought the things that touch me very deeply are these incredibly beautiful sacred geometric symbols that I think touch us in ways that language far surpasses anything that we can express linguistically. So I wanted to include these sacred geometric symbols that I hope lift us into realms that we don't even fully understand yet. And then I was playing with the Hebrew letters in addition to that. Again, the number 22, the 22 letters. After my loss, I was looking for something to engage my mind, and I started creating kaleidoscopic mandalas on the computer, which allowed me to do mirror images and reverse images and so on as I was just playing. I didn't know why I was doing it. I was just having fun. And when I started doing this tarot deck, I started looking at the shape of the Hebrew letters and thought, well, what if I do that, reverse the letters, place them back to back, turn them upside down, and so I found I was creating grids of the Hebrew letters that I then applied into each of these cards, each one representing a different Hebrew letter. And
wow.
You know, it's been said by people who feel the power of the letters that they carry a magic in and of themselves, that we don't necessarily have to understand Hebrew in order to know what the magic is. The vibration that they carry, both sound and visually, have the power to change our environment. And so I've incorporated grids of Hebrew letters into the actual illustration of the cards. Jewish mysticism, Kabbalah, teaches us that there are five levels of soul on which we operate. Three of them relate to letter, to number, and to story. And so I've tried to incorporate using the Hebrew number, the Hebrew letter, and the story of the female archetypes, a way for all of us to get into understanding about ourselves the building blocks that we use to create our own reality. It may sound very complicated the way we're talking about it now, but if people are curious, look at the cards, look at my website, look at the book. Hopefully it will take all of us on a journey that is meaningful to ourselves by bringing in my approach to the Hebrew alphabet and to Jewish mysticism that I hope will spark some sort of curiosity or a new journey for people who are interested. They don't have to be knowledgeable about Hebrew or about Jewish mysticism, but take it as an approach and invite their own journey to see where their intuitive will take them by looking at it in this particular way.
Yeah, it's sort of like don't overthink it, you know, just see with the images, you know, how they hit you,
yes.
You know, what epiphanies, what inspiration comes from them. Don't worry about what they necessarily mean in Kabbalah, but
exactly.
You know, what is it saying to you? And that's what you need to be aware of. So,
exactly.
You know, it sounds like you have created an incredibly rich tapestry. So the last question, Heather, before we let you go tonight, tell us a little bit about using essential oils to enhance intellect and intuition.
Well, what I felt was to make this a multisensory experience, which again is very different from the way tarot is used as a fortune-telling device, if we're using this as a spiritual tool for our own empowerment, to make this multisensory, how could we possibly do something that would, again, bring in all aspects of ourselves? Because as women, I think we intuitively go to the touch and the taste and the smell and the color and so on. So I've added the color to the actual illustrations. But a very close friend of mine and my own naturopath in San Luis Obispo, Dr. Zoe Wells, offered to work with me so that we looked at each of the cards and looked at the theme of what we are trying to develop as we look at the various cards. I was talking about Eve and the first card being trust and nurture, and what do we do to develop that within ourselves. With Zoe's help, I was able then to find essential oils that if we use at the time that we're actually doing the cards, will help us to bring into being the actual power, the energy that we're trying to develop, to evolve within ourselves. And so she came up with a list of 22 of these oils by researching whether it's that we're trying to overcome fear, whether we're trying to learn to celebrate our own freedom, whether we're overcoming our inability to deal with anger correctly, appropriately, the best way possible, not by denying it, but expressing it in a way that is not going to be destructive. there are various essential oils that can be used to assist us on our journey, and again, ways that we do not really understand. Just like the sacred geometry is to the eye, these essential oils work within the body by taking us to our olfactory sense and changing the vibration of what we're doing. So the idea was, as a spiritual practice, to use these tarot cards in a way that enriches us on more than just the intellectual level, the intuitive, the sight, the taste, the touch, the feel, so that, again, we can just become all that we are trying so hard to be.
Wonderful. Well, you know, and for people who might say, oh, you know, I'm not sure about those essential oils, somebody said this to me once, and it made total sense. I was in this shop, you know, trying to decide if I was going to buy into this idea of essential oils or not, you know, or if it was just a lot of, you know, New Age
yes.
hocus pocus. And the woman said to me, well, think about the last time you walked past a stinky dumpster.
Right.
How did that affect you?
Right.
And,
exactly.
And, you know, I got it, you know. I totally
yes.
got it. Well, yes. Heather, why don't you go ahead and tell listeners again how they can reach you, your websites.
Sure. Thank you so much, Karen. I have three websites, but heathermendell.com. HEATHERMENDEL, heathermendell.com is my main website that leads to the others. The one that I've developed for the Syzygy Oracle is called www.sacredfemininekabbalah.com. The book is for sale. The cards are for sale. They're also available through Amazon, as well as through all the traditional, independent booksellers. People are more than welcome to email me through the website if they want any information. I'm delighted to say that through whatever connections I am developing through Facebook and the web, the cards are selling internationally, which is really very exciting, as well as here in the United States. And
well, congratulations.
Thank you. I'm just hoping for those who are familiar with tarot and Kabbalah, this just adds another something into their already large repertoire. And for people like yourself who may not have gone into tarot yet, maybe find that this is a way of looking into it and seeing if there's anything there for them. So
I was just going to say, well, I'm definitely looking forward to it. And, you know, I say that with all sincerity.
Thank you. And all I can say to you, Karen, is thank you so much for having me on. I wish you much strength in the wonderful work that you're doing, and continue to look forward to hearing what you're going to bring to consciousness for all of us, and just wish you all good things in what you're doing.
Well, thank you so much. And, you know, I didn't realize till I paid a little bit more attention to your phone number that we're neighbors, more or less. I'm in Venice Beach. And
yes.
If you're interested, I'm going to be doing a presentation for my new book in Malibu in April. And I'm also going to be down at the Goddess Temple and in Whittier. But if you're interested in you know, coming to any of those, let me know. I'd love to meet you in person.
It would be wonderful. It's been wonderful knowing you this way, and I look forward to our paths crossing in person. And thank you so much for the opportunity to be on your show.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Good night, and thank you so much for
thank
the
you.
Insights you know, you've given listeners. I think
my
you
pleasure.
Have an awesome book and deck here. Thank you, Heather. Thank you.
Thanks, Karen. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, listeners, if you know what this means, maybe if you've been a listener for a while, you know. Or this one. Yes. We are about to get into my What's the Buzz segment. I've been promising this for a while, and we've just had so many great guests. When I have two guests a night, I just run out of time. But I made sure I had time to go through these things I've been promising you for the last few weeks. So first up, if you listen to my Beyond 50 Shades of Grey interview with Dr. David Hillman, this will be meaningful for you. We talked about sex, drugs, and, you know, that sort of thing in the ancient world and the role of priestesses and, you know, what were they really doing in these mystery temples. And anyway, this was some comments from one of my listeners who finally got a chance to catch it in the archives. She says, I finally got to listen to this interview with Dr. David Hillman. Great show. I didn't find it too shocking. True, the ancients had different attitudes towards certain sexual practices, and I suppose that is what might offend some. Doesn't offend me, though. I wouldn't support violating men any more than I would violating women. In terms of women's power, I'm still trying to visualize that room full of women and imagining the power of experiencing that. Ha ha. And I'm a very private person. The serpent actually crawling into the vagina, well, that gives a whole new spin on the relationship between priestess and snake. Very fascinating. And the chemicals that would interact, this should be studied by scientists. Snake venom is used for heart conditions. It's the basis of one whole branch of heart medications. And I totally agree with you about sex and well-being. Remember that Seinfeld episode? I thought that was hitting on an underlying truth as well. And she refers to season 8, episode 9 of Seinfeld, the abstinence. Abstinence allows George to become a genius, but it turns Elaine into an idiot. Anyway, she goes on to say, what I took as the main point of all the information Dr. Hillman conveyed strikes me as so true, that crushing the serpent, in quotes, Mary Condren's phrase, I'm thinking of serpent as woman's potency here, goes hand in hand with crushing humanity. I guess I also think that a society that knows how to make and keep women strong is a society that can only be humane all around. Really fascinating to hear Dr. Hillman link our power to our sexuality, liminal capacities. Yes, yes, yes. Why else do men rape or practice abstinence except to try to shame our sexual power out of us, to make us feel that our power is really our weakness or bad? In a way, this interview reminded me, and it ties into Naomi Wolf's book, Vagina, a Biography. Very sad to hear that some viewers thought the show's discussion was about filth. Such a reaction says a lot about how patriarchal hegemony, with its sexual pessimism and demonization of us all, is still so firmly entrenched within some women's psyches. So thank you, dear listener, for that, you know, very insightful feedback. Let's see, the other article I wanted to share with you, this comes from the Huffington Post. Antonia Bloomberg wrote this article titled, Ordained Women, Mormon Women's Advocacy Group Denied Access to LDS Church Meeting. I'm just going to give you little snippets of it. A Mormon church official notified the women's advocacy group called Ordained Women, you can find them at ordainedwomen.org, that it would not be granted tickets nor allowed to protest in Salt Lake City's historic Temple Square during the faith's general priesthood meeting on April 5th. The group, which celebrated its one-year anniversary on March 17th, seeks to bring gender equality and women's ordination to the table in a faith that they say has a long tradition of equality. Well, not all Mormon women agree with the cause, however. The official church letter denying the group Ordained Women access to the upcoming meeting came from LDS public affairs spokeswoman Jessica Mooney. Mooney wrote, women in the church, by a very large majority, do not share your advocacy for priesthood ordination for women and consider that position to be extreme. She went on to affirm the purpose for the April 5th meeting, which she says was to strengthen men and boys, blah, blah, blah. In her letter, Mooney also urged ordained women not to protest in the revered Temple Square for fear it would detract from the session. Kate Kelly, a human rights attorney in Washington and one of the group's founders, found this to be particularly a harsh blow and said, if we are excluded from even walking on hallowed ground in the temple, it will be very, very, very devastating to a lot of women who feel so excluded and so marginalized. The church's move to deny ordained women access to the meeting may have served to escalate an otherwise peaceful disagreement. Anyway, it we'll hear a little bit more. She says she thinks this is a PR disaster for the church. Goliath is never going to get better press than David. The optics are terrible and unnecessary, she said, given that ordained women had announced that the April conference would be the second and final time the group planned to seek priesthood tickets. Anyway, the point of my reading this is so that you understand that, you know, things are being shaken up even in the Mormon church. You know, these Mormon women are, you know, are not happy with their second class status. But my question is, and it goes back to some of what we talked about with Kathy and Heather, why do women continue to be complicit in their own inequality, falling for male dogma that they aren't equal? You know, awaken, women, awaken. Stand in solidarity with your sisters, not the status quo. And which takes me to the next article Jeanette sent in. It's by Christine Schenck from the Simply Spirit blog. It says, is religion the biggest problem facing feminism today? Now, I'm only going to give you snippets of it. It's a very long article. But so just some of the stuff at the beginning, and then if you want to go find it, I'm sure you can. Just Google, is religion the biggest problem facing feminism today? And it will pop up, I promise you. Christine Schenck says, an email arrived in my inbox about 2 weeks ago with this provocative subject line, is religion the biggest problem facing feminism today? Turns out a columnist from Sojourners, Jamie Calloway Hanauer, had blogged about Gloria Steinem's response to Jennifer Aniston at the first ever Makers Conference held in February in Los Angeles. Sponsored by PBS and AOL, the conference heard from a veritable who's who of respected women leaders, from Gwen Ifill to Helen DeGeneres to Carol Burnett to, well, Gloria Steinem. Along with many Catholic women of my generation, I'm a big fan of Steinem. She's modest, calm, reasoned, and strong. She leads a movement that is changing the lives of women worldwide for the better. After Aniston asked her, what do you think the biggest problem with feminism today is, Steinem named religion as one of the biggest problems after anti-feminism and income disparity. Quote, we don't talk about enough, is religion. I think that spirituality is one thing, but religion is just politics in the sky. I think we really have to talk about it because it gains power from silence, unquote. That's Steinem. And the article author, Christine, goes on to say, well, I'm not sure I agree that religion is just politics in the sky. One can easily see why Steinem might believe it. Look at the political flack American sisters experienced from church leaders for supporting expanded access to health care for low-income people. U.S. bishops opposed the Affordable Care Act because of the women's issue of access to family planning. Would anyone deny that the politics of religion influenced this struggle? Not me. And then the sisters were criticized for being radical feminists to boot. I've always liked Elizabeth Schuessler Forienza's definition of feminism, quoting British suffragist Rebecca West, quote, feminism is the radical notion that women are people, unquote. People in the same way men are people, and that means women have the same basic human rights and responsibilities to themselves and to the human family that men do. But our world doesn't believe that. Up to 70% of women worldwide encounter violence, and 1 in 3 will be beaten, coerced into sex, or otherwise abused in her life. 6 out of 10 migrant women from Central America are raped on their journey to the United States. Too often, civil and religious authorities look the other way or blame the victims. If standing up for basic human rights for women makes me a radical feminist, then I am proud to plead guilty as charged. Amnesty International has launched a new women's rights or human rights campaign to address escalating violence and oppression against women throughout the world. They're pushing the U.S. to join 185 other countries and ratify the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, otherwise known as CED. CEDAW, or the Treaty for the Rights of Women. Already, the CEDAW has had far-reaching influence in fostering the development of domestic violence laws in Turkey, Nepal, South Africa, and the Republic of Korea, as well as anti-trafficking laws in the Ukraine and Moldova. It is shocking that the United States is the only industrialized democracy and the only country in the Western Hemisphere that has not yet ratified this treaty. Amnesty International is encouraging calls to U.S. Senators and President Obama to ratify and implement the CEDAW. You can find out more, and she has a link. I'm sure all you have to do is Google CEDAW. Crazy, isn't it? And going back to religion, why do you think the United States is the only industrialized democracy and the only country in the Western Hemisphere that has not yet ratified the treaty? Guess. Religion. Guess what religion? I think you probably know. Okay, moving on. Thank you, Jane, for sending me this. It's kind of funny, tongue-in-cheek. It's called A Day in the Life of Joe Republican. Joe gets up at 6 a.m. and fills his coffee pot with water to prepare his morning coffee. The water is clean and good because some tree-hugging liberal fought for minimum water quality standards. With his first swallow of water, he takes his daily medication. His medications are safe to take because some stupid commie liberal fought to ensure their safety and that they work as advertised. All but $10 of his medications are paid for by his employer's medical plan because some liberal union workers fought their employers for paid medical insurance. Now Joe gets it too. He prepares his morning breakfast, bacon and eggs. Joe's bacon is safe to eat because some girly man liberal fought for laws to regulate the meatpacking industry. In the morning shower, Joe reaches for his shampoo. His bottle is properly labeled with each ingredient and its amount and the total contents because some crybaby liberal fought for his right to know what he was putting on his body and how much he contained. Joe dresses, walks outside, and takes a deep breath. The air he breathes is clean because some environmentalist wacko liberal fought for laws to stop industries from polluting our air. He walks to the subway station for his government-subsidized ride to work. It saves him considerable money in parking and transportation fees because some fancy-pants liberal fought for affordable public transportation, which gives everyone the opportunity to be a contributor. Joe begins his workday. He has a good job with excellent pay, medical benefits, retirement, paid holidays, and vacation because, you know what, some lazy liberal union members fought and died for these working standards. Joe's employer pays these standards because Joe's employer doesn't want his employees to call the union. If Joe's hurt on the job or becomes unemployed, he'll get a worker comp or unemployment check because some stupid liberal didn't think he should lose his home because of his temporary misfortune. Well, it's noontime, and Joe needs to make a bank deposit so he can pay some bills. Joe's deposit is federally insured by the FSLIC because some godless liberal wanted to protect Joe's money from unscrupulous bankers who ruined the banking system before the Great Depression. Joe has to pay his Fannie Mae underwritten mortgage and his below-market federal student loan because some elitist liberal decided that Joe and the government would be better off if he was educated and earned more money over his lifetime. Well, Joe's home from work now. He plans to visit his father this evening at his farm home in the country. He gets in his car for the drive. His car is among the safest in the world because some American-hating liberal fought for car safety standards. He arrives at his boyhood home. His was the third generation to live in the house, financed by Farmers Home Administration, because bankers didn't want to make rural loans. The house didn't have electricity until some big government liberal stuck his nose where it didn't belong and demanded rural electrification. Well, he's happy to see his father, who's now retired. His father lives on Social Security and a union pension because some wine-drinking, cheese-eating liberal made sure he could take care of himself so Joe wouldn't have to. Joe gets back in his car for the ride home and turns on the radio talk show. The radio host keeps saying that liberals are bad and conservatives are good. He doesn't mention that the beloved Republicans have fought against every protection and benefit Joe enjoys throughout his day. Joe agrees. We don't need these big government liberals ruining our lives. After all, I'm a self-made man who believes everyone should take care of themselves, just like I have. Well, This was written by William J. Johnson, president of Halsted Communications in New York. And I thank William for writing it, and I thank Jane for sending it. And we still have a few more minutes. I can get to these other things that I promised. And I promise I'm going to leave you on an upbeat note. Well, with Women's History Month this month, there was lots of different things in the news, and this comes from the MsMagazine.com blog, and it's titled Indian Women Reclaim Buses for International Women's Day. It's by Holly Curl. She says, when I spent a week in Delhi, India, to attend an international conference on women's safety, I saw many public buses around the city as I walked a road in auto rickshaws. Each of the crowded buses was almost entirely full of men. It was so rare to see women on a bus that if I did, I'd point it out to my traveling companion. The lack of women on buses is due in large part to women feeling unsafe in public spaces. In a survey released last year by UN Women and the International Center for Research on Women, researchers found that 95% of girls and women in Delhi, India, saw public spaces as unsafe. 9 out of 10 girls and women said they had experienced sexual aggression or violence in public spaces in the city during their lifetime. Then in a 2010 survey by UN agencies, harassed women said buses were the least safe form of public transportation. Unwanted verbal harassment, leering, touching were widely cited as problems. Stories such as the gang rape and murder of a 23-year-old Delhi student on a bus in late 2012, an atrocious incident that prompted protests across India, certainly contribute to feelings of insecurity. While some may think that keeping women off the streets and out of buses is the best way to keep them safe, the global human rights organization Breakthrough disagrees. They want women to know that they have the right to occupy public spaces and suggest that having more women in public spaces can help reduce harassment. To encourage more women to ride the bus in Delhi, on March 1st, they launched a Board the Bus campaign, which runs through March 8th, International Women's Day. We're calling on women who don't normally take the bus to board the bus with us, digital media strategist Radhika Chakru says. We're telling women who take the bus regularly that they don't have to go it alone. If everyone goes together, there's a very real chance we can make the bus or any public space safer. Board the Bus website encourages people to ride the bus to get people thinking, talking, and acting, and to take back the space that was always yours. Participants can tweet about their experiences with the hashtag, #BoardTheBus, and share a photo of their ride. Leading up to the week, Breakthrough held a series of online and on-the-ground activities like flash mobs and radio spot ads to generate a public discussion about women's safety in public spaces. Adding more women to buses will not immediately or entirely eliminate harassment, though, and there are still safety tactics many women who ride the buses feel they must take. One is riding with a friend or in a group. Explains one woman, we have a fixed time. All five of us girls met in the bus, and we traveled together every day to work and back. And after 3 years now, I feel they're like my sisters. I share everything with them. Other women only ride the bus during the day. Farhana, a student, says, I only feel safe traveling by bus in the daytime because it's crowded and there are less chances of being in trouble. I prefer not to board a bus after 5 in the evening. 25% of seats are reserved for women near the front of the bus. When I asked her about her thoughts on this kind of sex segregation, she said, I'm opposed to segregation as a solution to the issue, but I can't deny it provides many women with a sense of security and others with freedom to travel independently. Clearly, women cannot solve this alone, and it's important to bring men into the conversation. Breakthrough's campaign encourages men to participate and break out if they witness harassment on buses. They can be that guy who works to create a world where everyone is treated respectfully. They can also educate other men about the inappropriateness of their behavior. Recently, students at Whistling Woods International, a film school in India, released a PSA meant to force men to consider how creepy and inappropriate their leering is, including on buses. Its powerful message has been viewed more than 3 million times. If you live in Delhi, consider joining the campaign and boarding a bus. On the last stop of the campaign, join hundreds of women at 4 o'clock. Well, this happened March 8th. If you're not in Delhi, spread the word about the campaign to those who are, and you can participate by traveling through Delhi on your own virtual bus. You can consider riding a bus in your own community. Chances are harassment is a problem there, too, making many people, especially women, feel unsafe. So if you go to MsMagazine.com, this article that I'm reading you has links to all of these different things. You can read, you can see that PSA that got released. You can find links to that group, Be That Guy, for, you know, so that men can help, you know, help in this process to create a safer place for women. There's the Board the Bus website. You can find out about the statistics, the surveys about the organization Breakthrough. So, yeah, just go to MsMagazine.com, Indian Women Reclaim Buses for International Women's Day. And the final article, because I thought this was really awesome, and it speaks to how men are really our allies. Let's see. This comes from Pat. I want to thank her. She's always sending me great stuff. And it comes from the daysforgirls.org website, daysforgirls.org website. You might want to take a look at that yourself. It seems like it's a source of good stuff. It's a fantastic story. It's titled, The Indian Sanitary Pad Revolution by Vibeke Venema of BBC World Service. Okay. A school dropout from a poor family in southern India has revolutionized menstrual health for rural women in developing countries by inventing a simple machine they can use to make cheap sanitary pads. Arun Maruga, in his invention, came at great personal cost. He nearly lost his family, his money, and his place in society, but he kept his sense of humor, and this is his story. He says, it all started with my wife. In 1998, he was newly married, and his world revolved around his wife, Shanti, and his widowed mother. One day, he saw Shanti was hiding something from him. He was shocked to discover what it was, rags, nasty cloths which she used during menstruation. I'll be honest, said Muru, I would not even use it to clean my scooter. When he asked her why she didn't use sanitary pads, she pointed out that if she bought them for the women in the family, she wouldn't be able to afford to buy milk or run the household. Well, wanting to impress his young wife, Murugu went into town to buy her a sanitary pad. It was handed to him hurriedly as if it were contraband. He weighed it in his hand and wondered why 10 grams, less than 0.5 ounces of cotton, which at the time cost 10 passe, which is 0.001 pounds, should sell for 4 rupees, 40 times the price. He decided he could make them cheaper himself. He fashioned a sanitary pad out of cotton and gave it to Shanti, demanding immediate feedback. She said he'd have to wait for some time. Only then did he realize that periods were monthly. He said, I can't wait a month for each feedback. It'll take 2 decades. So he needed more volunteers. When Murugu looked into it further, he discovered that hardly any women in the surrounding villages used sanitary pads, fewer than 1 in 10. His findings were echoed by a 2011 survey by A.C. Nielsen commissioned by the Indian government, which found that only 12% of women across India use sanitary pads. Murugu said that in rural areas, the take-up is far less than that. He was shocked to learn that women don't just use old rags, but other unhygienic substances such as sand, sawdust, leaves, even ash. Women who do use cloths are often too embarrassed to dry them in the sun, which means they don't get disinfected. Approximately 70% of all reproductive diseases in India are caused by poor menstrual hygiene. It can also affect maternal mortality. Finding volunteers to test his products was no mean, easy feat. His sisters refused, so he had the idea of approaching female students at his local medical college. But how can a workshop worker approach a medical college girl? Murugu says, not even college boys go near these girls. He managed to convince 20 students, though, to try out his pads, but it still didn't quite work out. On the day he came to collect their feedback sheets, he caught 3 of the girls industriously filling them all in. The results obviously could not be relied on. It was then that he decided to test the products on himself. I became the man who wore a sanitary pad, he said. He created a uterus from a football bladder by punching a couple of holes in it and filling it with goat's blood. A former classmate, a butcher, would ring his bicycle bell outside the house whenever he was going to kill a goat. Marugu would collect the blood and mix it in an additive he got from another friend at a blood bank to prevent it from clotting too quickly, but it didn't stop the smell. He walked, cycled, and ran with a football bladder under his traditional clothes, constantly pumping blood out to test his sanitary pad's absorption rates. Everyone thought he'd gone mad. He used to wash his bloody clothes at the public well, and the whole village concluded he had a sexual disease. Friends crossed the road to avoid him. I had become a pervert, he says. At the same time, his wife got fed up and left him. So you see God's sense of humor, he says, in the documentary Menstrual Man by Amit Vermani. Look for that, listeners, Menstrual Man. He says, I started the research for my wife, and after 18 months, she left me. Then he had another brainwave. He would study used sanitary pads. Surely this would reveal something or everything. This idea posed an even greater risk in such a superstitious community. Even if I asked for a hair from a lady, she would suspect I'm doing some black magic on her to mesmerize her, he says. But he supplied his group of medical students with sanitary pads and collected them afterwards. He laid his haul out in the backyard to study, only for his mother to stumble across the grisly scene one afternoon. Well, that was the final straw. She cried, put her sari on the ground, put her belongings in it, and left. It was a problem for me, he said. I had to cook my own food now. Worse was to come. The villagers became convinced he was possessed by evil spirits and were about to chain him upside down to a tree to be healed by the local soothsayer. He only narrowly avoided this treatment by agreeing to leave the village. It was a terrible price to pay. My wife gone, my mom gone, ostracized from my village. I was left all alone in life. Still, he carried on. The biggest mystery was what successful sanitary pads were made of. He had sent some off for laboratory analysis, and reports came back that it was cotton, but his own cotton creations didn't work. It was something he could only ask the multinational companies who produce sanitary products, but how? It's like knocking on the door of Coke and saying, can I ask how your Coke is manufactured? Marugu wrote to the big manufacturing companies with the help of a college professor who he repaid by doing domestic work. He didn't speak much English at the time. He also spent almost 7,000 rupees on telephone calls, money he didn't have. When I got through, they would ask me what kind of plant I had. He says I really didn't understand what they meant. In the end, he said he was a textile mill owner and who was thinking of moving into the business and requested some samples. A few weeks later, mysterious hard boards appeared in the mail, cellulose from the bark of a tree. It had taken 2 years and 3 months to discover what sanitary pads are made of, but there was a snag. The machine required to break this material down and turn it into pads cost many thousands of dollars, and so he would have to design one himself. 4.5 years later, he succeeded in creating a low-cost method for the production of sanitary towels. The process involves 4 simple steps. First, a machine similar to a kitchen grinder breaks down the hard cellulose into fluffy material, which is packed into rectangular cakes with another machine. The cakes are then wrapped in non-woven cloth and disinfected in an ultraviolet treatment unit. The whole process can be learned in an hour. Marugu's goal was to create user-friendly technology. The mission was not just to increase the use of sanitary pads, but also to create jobs for rural women, women like his mother. Following her husband's death in a road accident, Marugu's mother had had to sell everything she owned to get a job as a farm laborer, but earning a dollar a day wasn't enough to support 4 children. That's why at the age of 14, Marugu had left school to find work. The machines are kept deliberately simple and skeletal so that they can be maintained by the women themselves. It looks like the Wright brothers' first flight, he says. The first model was mostly made of wood, and when he showed it to the Indian Institute of Technology in Madras, scientists were skeptical. How is this man going to compete against multinationals? But Marugu had confidence. As the son of a hand loom worker, he had seen his father survive with a simple wooden hand loom, despite 446 fully mechanized mills in the city. That gave him the courage to take on the big companies with his small machine made of wood. Besides, his aim was not really to compete. We are creating a new market. We are paving the way for them, he says. Unbeknownst to him, the ITT, the Indian Institute of Technology, entered his machine in a competition for a National Innovation Award. Out of 943 entries, it came first. He was given the award by the then president of India. Quite an achievement for a school dropout. Suddenly, he was in the limelight. It was instant glory, media flashing in my face, everything, he says. The irony is, after 5.5 years, I get a call on my mobile. The voice huskily says, "Remember me?" Well, it was his wife, Shanti. She was not entirely surprised by her husband's success. Every time he comes to know something new, he wants to know everything about it, she says. And then he wants to do something about it that nobody else has done before. However, this kind of ambition was not easy to live with. Not only was she shocked by his interest in such a matter, but it took up all of his time and money. At the time, they hardly had enough money to eat properly, and her troubles were compounded by all the gossip. The hardest thing was when the villagers started talking and treating us really badly, she says. There were rumors that he was having affairs with other women, and that was why he was doing such things. So she decided to go home and live with her mother. After Shanti, eventually Marugu's own mother and the rest of the villagers, who had all condemned, criticized, and ostracized him, they all came around too. Marugu seemed set for fame and fortune, but he was not interested in profit. Imagine, I got patent rights to the only machine in the world to make low-cost sanitary napkins, a hot cake product. Anyone with an MBA would immediately accumulate the maximum money, but I did not want to. Why? Because from childhood I know no human being died because of poverty. Everything happens because of ignorance. He believes that the big business is parasitic, like a mosquito, whereas he prefers the lighter touch, like that of a butterfly. A butterfly can suck honey from the flower without damaging it, he says. There are still many taboos around menstruation in India. Women can't visit temples or public places. They're not allowed to cook or touch the water supply. Essentially, they are considered untouchable. It took Marugu 18 months to build 250 machines, which he took out to the poorest and most underdeveloped states in northern India, the so-called Dumaru, or six states of in India. Here, women often have to walk for miles to fetch water, something they can't do when they're menstruating, so families suffer. He said, "My inner conscience said if I can crack it in Bihar, a very tough nut to crack, I can make it anywhere." It was hard to even broach the subject in such conservative society. To speak to rural women, we need permission from the husband or the father, he says. We can only talk to them through a blanket. There are also myths and fears surrounding the use of sanitary pads, that women who use them will go blind, for example, or will never get married. But slowly, slowly, village by village, there was cautious acceptance, and over time the machine spread to 1,300 villages in 23 states. In each case, it's the women who produce the sanitary pads who sell them directly to the customer. Shops are usually run by men, which can put women off. And when the customers get them from women, they know they can also acquire important information on how to use them. Purchasers may not even need any money. Many women barter for onions and potatoes. While getting the message out to new areas of the country is still difficult, Marugu is skeptical about the effectiveness of TV advertising. "You always have a girl in white jeans jumping over a wall," he says. "They never talk about hygiene." Well, most of Marugu's clients are NGOs and women's self-help groups. A manual machine costs less than 75,000 Indian rupees. A semi-automatic machine costs more. Each machine converts 3,000 women to pad usage and provides employment for 10. They can produce 200 to 250 pads a day, which sell for an average of about 2.5 rupees each. Women choose their own brand name for their range of sanitary pads, so it's no overarching brand. It's by the women, for the women, and to the women. Marugu also works with schools. 23% of girls drop out of education once they start menstruating. Now schoolgirls make their own pads. Why wait till they're women? Why not empower girls? The Indian government recently announced it would distribute subsidized sanitary products to poor women. It was a blow for Marugu that it did not choose to work with him, but he now has his eyes on the wider world. My aim was to create 1 million jobs for poor women, but why not 10 million jobs worldwide? He is expanding to 106 countries across the globe, including Kenya, Nigeria, Philippines, Bangladesh. Our success is entirely down to word-of-mouth publicity, he says, because this is a problem all developing nations face. Marugu now lives with his family in a modest apartment. He owns a Jeep, and he has no desire to accumulate possessions. I have accumulated no money, but I accumulate a lot of happiness, he says. If you get rich, you have an apartment with an extra bedroom, and then you die. He prefers to spend his time talking to university and college students. He's an engaging and funny speaker despite his idiosyncratic English. He says he's not working brain to brain but heart to heart. Luckily, I'm not educated, he tells students. If you act like an illiterate man, your learning will never stop. Being uneducated, you have no fear of the future. His wife Shanti agrees with him on the point. If he had completed his education, he would be like any other guy who works for someone else who gets a daily wage. But because he did not complete school, he had the courage to come out to start a business of his own. Now he's employing other people. Shanti and Marugu are now a tight unit. My wife, the business, is not a separate thing. It is mixed up with our life, he says. When a girl reaches puberty in her village, there is a ceremony. Traditionally, it meant that they were ready to marry. Shanti always brings a sanitary pad as a gift and explains how to use it. Initially, I used to be very shy when talking to people about it, she said, but after all this time, people had started to open up. Now they come and talk to me. They ask questions, and they also get sanitary napkins to try. They have all changed a lot in the village. Marugu says she does a wonderful job. He was once asked whether receiving the award from the Indian president was the happiest moment of his life. He said no. His proudest moment came after he installed a machine in a remote village in the foothills of the Himalayas where for many generations nobody had earned enough to allow children to go to school. A year later, he received a call from a woman in that village to say that her daughter had started school. Where Nehru failed, he says, one machine succeeded. Anu Marugu spoke to Outlook on the BBC World Service. You can hear him talk and blah, blah, blah. So anyway, you can look that up for yourself if you like. But wasn't that a wonderful story? Made me think of Heather talking about the fool of the tarot deck, you know, naively jumping into things that you never know where they're going to take you, but sometimes they take you in wonderful directions. So I'm going to close tonight on another quick upbeat sharing. And this comes from Karen Berg from the Kabbalah Center. It's called A Whole World Unto Ourselves. We may not realize it, but life is fleeting and passes like the blink of an eye. So it seems strange that so often we act as if we have many years to live and as though our thoughts and actions don't have any effect or consequences. But the truth is that a single positive action, an action of certainty, can affect the whole world. How? Consider this. Each person has many roles in this life, sister, brother, mother, father, employer, employee, and so on. Every life affects the lives of all of those in the same circle, and what happens in that circle extends outward, incrementally, in a ripple effect. Ultimately, the whole world can be affected by a single person, and each person is a whole world unto himself or herself. Therefore, we need to fully understand that every action we take, everything we do, connects with someone who will inevitably be affected by it. Seems like our themes are repeated over and over, aren't they? Well, dear listeners, thank you so very much for tuning in tonight, and I'll close with the motto of our show by Gandhi. First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. Thank you so very much for listening. Thank you for your listener loyalty. Thank you for all your feedback. Have a wonderful week. I'll be with you again next Wednesday. Good night.